It's not exactly news that America's school systems are facing their greatest fiscal challenges since the Great Depression. For the first time in decades, real per-pupil spending will decline this year, forcing school districts to make painful budget choices, providing fewer services with their diminished resources. Or so goes the conventional wisdom. Is it possible, on the other hand, that this economic downturn could be seized as an opportunity to rethink how education is delivered and to find approaches that are dramatically more affordable and effective? Nate Levinson thinks so. He's the managing director of the District Management Council, a former superintendent in Arlington, Massachusetts, and a former business executive. He joins us today via Skype to talk about his book, Smarter Budgets, Smarter Schools, How to Survive and Thrive in Tight Times, and the reception it's received to date. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, Nate, you have written an incredibly important and timely book, and what I love about it, it's really packed with real-life examples of districts finding better ways to do more with less. I'm curious, before we get into the content, I'm just curious, how have superintendents and school board members responded to the advice in the book so far? Do they think your ideas are nuts, or they seem pretty interested?
I've actually been relieved that they don't see them as crazy. I think there's been a lot of people who have suspected, had the feeling that, of course, we can be more effective, more cost-effective, that doing more with less is possible. But that was an idea, and I think this book helps bridge the gap from that idea to very concrete things to how you actually do that, both technically and dealing with the ever-present politics of making those kind of changes.
Okay. Yeah. So, and this comes partly from your own experience as a school superintendent. What was your experience with budget cuts and trying to rein in spending?
Well, the good news is, while I was a superintendent, I oversaw some fairly dramatic increases in student achievement. We saw scores rise very substantially. We saw programs offering expand pretty significantly. And we did that during a time of very significant budget cuts. We were reducing real spending year after year. And we had a growing student population. So I know firsthand that you can, in fact, do more with less. And I have a lot of scars to prove it.
Right. I mean, that's part of the question. You can do more with less, but can you keep your job after you do that? You work now with a bunch of districts and superintendents around the country, New England especially. I mean, do you see people surviving politically when they make these tough choices?
I think the answer is mixed. And I think the one cautionary note is if you only deal with the technical side of managing a budget, that's very insufficient. And dealing with the political side, and the book spends a lot of time sharing lessons learned, both mistakes I made, and I made plenty, and really successes that we've seen elsewhere. So I think you can, and as the world finances get tighter, there is more acceptance, both inside school districts and from the community, that something's got to change. And I think that's one of the biggest differences. The cuts and the changes are coming no matter what, and it's only whether they're going to be done well or poorly is the question.
And so you need to worry about building a political constituency for these kinds of changes, for the messaging, or else they're just going to shoot the messenger, right?
That does happen far too often.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into some of the substance here. One of the first things you write about is this concept of trading down. Doing different, not less. Could you explain that to us?
Sure. One of the most interesting things I noticed as somebody coming from the business world into the education world was just how few types of people work in school systems. And I mean by types of people, we're talking contractually. There are teachers, there are paraprofessionals, there are administrators. So maybe three types. If you look at other walks of life, there are many, many more layers, many different types of positions. So how that plays out in a school district is a PE teacher and a physics teacher are paid exactly the same. Nurses are paid in most districts exactly the same as a teacher. And in most other settings, a physics teacher is not interchangeable with a PE teacher, a nurse is not a teacher. They all would have been paid differently. So because everybody is paid roughly the same or on the same schedule, what ends up happening is some people are paid more than market and some people are paid less than market. The trading down idea is to look at those places where union contracts have created above market wages and ask, are there other people out in the world or that could do that, fill that role at market wages that would be as well or better quality of service and at a lower cost? So a couple quick examples. The first would be, if you're using registered nurses in every building, could you use a mix of registered nurses and nurse practitioners or licensed nursing assistants? Could PE teachers be swapped for health club instructors? Other roles, other types of people who tend to have different wage expectations, but would potentially be able to do the job reasonably well as well.
In your own experience, you even took on librarians, right?
Now, the librarians is a really interesting example and one near and dear to my heart because I love books and I love libraries. And as a superintendent, we invested an enormous amount in improving elementary reading. So people found it a little odd that I was tackling librarians when I was such a big fan and a supporter of funding for reading. But what we did, and again, this is where context matters. We studied in great detail what everybody did in the district to determine where there was value and where there was less value. And it turns out that when librarians, you know, had this image of teaching kids to read, embedding a love of learning and a love of reading, and those are really good things, but the reality was very different. First of all, most librarians only worked less than half time because we assigned one per school. So if you had a school, we had one very small school that had 12 classrooms, which meant 12 periods a week kids came in. But full-time people are supposed to have 25 periods a week. And secondly, what we saw was that they mostly checked out books, but they hardly did that because we had implemented classroom libraries, so the kids brought their home books to the library. And at the end of the day, the actual observation said they managed a classroom of kids reading silently. That was not a high value service for a district that was really short on money. And therefore we decided to both reduce the total number of librarians because they weren't needed. And secondly, to move to library paraprofessionals and to use those funds to hire more certified reading teachers to support our reading program.
I love that. It's such a great example. And so trying to find a way to use that same money for much more high impact investment. But still, the politics are such that could not have been easy. I mean, that means people losing their jobs and union contracts and all the rest. This was happening in Massachusetts, which is not exactly a right-to-work state.
And I think this goes to how you have to manage the politics and the process. And this goes to my own personal learning experience. The first year I proposed this change, I nearly had my head chopped off, including my own principals hated the idea. Absolutely rushed to their defense and said any move to tackle librarians was a move against literacy and I should be embarrassed. So that was my first attempt. I learned a little bit from that and said, fine, my understanding of what we're doing and yours is very different. So we're going to have a joint fact-finding committee. We're going to bring in a team of principals, a team of independent, fairly objective people to go and observe what's going on in the library every day. We're going to collect and analyze data on what is happening, how many periods each librarian is working, what are they doing the rest of the day. We actually calculated how many books are being checked out. The answer was sometimes we could go virtually an entire week without a book being checked out. And by having those facts, and by having, quite honestly, some of the critics help collect the facts, there was a great, oh my Lord. Then for people to know why we were doing this change. It wasn't because I disliked these people. It was I really, really needed reading teachers. And when the principals learned that the money would go for reading teachers, that they in fact would be the ones to hire the new reading teachers, and that we really weren't giving up much, all of a sudden what was like an unthinkable politically became, well, of course we should do that. And I think that goes to the issue of managing the process as much as having a good idea.
All right. So we go from that third rail topic to another one, class size. You seem to indicate in this book that class size should not be such a sacred cow, as Arne Duncan called it recently.
It can't be. So let's just move past this philosophical question of should it or shouldn't. Class size is the single biggest lever affecting district-wide spending. Depending on the district, but roughly 65% of all costs go into teachers, classroom teachers, special education teachers, things that are driven by class size. As budgets get tight, we're going to be making changes to class size because nobody has figured out how to balance budgets otherwise. So to me, the question isn't do you or don't you, but how do you? And what I've, now the good news is, yes, all the research says class size is not the critical driver of student achievement. We know on a most basic level that if we gave a parent the choice of them picking the best teacher in the school and having a class of 30, or us picking a teacher at random for a class of 15, most parents will go for 30. So I think we generally can accept that a great teacher matters a lot, and a lot more than class size. So the question is, how do you manage class size? And my answer is with far more nuance than we currently do it. In almost every elementary school, if we have a class size of 22, because we think that's the right size for a first grade elementary class, but we send 22 kids to gym. Well, couldn't you send 32 or 44? We don't have to link non-core classes to the core class size. Most districts, when they think about class size, first grade and fifth grade are often lumped together, but we've found that parents and teachers are more comfortable, perhaps with larger class sizes starting in fourth and fifth grade. So I think the idea of being much more nuanced is the first. And the second is, what's the trade-off? When I was on the school board in the town I live in, we had very small class sizes, but nothing else. No reading teachers, no guidance counselors, no social workers, no mentors, no coaches. And if people can understand that we're swapping class size, even very, very small changes in class size can fund an enormous amount of support for teachers. And it's my belief that all those support structures, which might equal one or two students in a classroom additional, is a much better package.
And you even seem to imply in the book, though, that you could go to huge classes in some cases. I mean, 50, 100.
The book specifically calls out a number of things that I have labeled crazy ideas. So I figured I should call them crazy before somebody else does. But they're not all that crazy. At least I don't think so. And the idea of 100 students in a class, I know at first blush seems just absurd. And the story I tell in the book is very personal because it's my own children. And it goes as follows. Two of my sons taking AP calculus, different schools. One didn't really care a lot about small classes. They had about 32 kids in his calculus class. Great teacher. They learned a lot of calculus, and most of the kids scored fours and fives on the AP test. My other son, very strong math student at a school that values small classes, about 15 students in the class. Teacher was not nearly as talented, and most of this kid scored one or two on the AP test, which meant they get no credit for the course. But here's the great irony. Because they did not learn calculus in a class of 15, when they go off to college, they will take calculus in a class of 60 to 100. Colleges have classes of 100. We say that one of the roles of high school is to prepare kids for college. If a college has a way of teaching effectively with 100 students, might not juniors and seniors actually even benefit from college-like classes of 100 students?
That's a really, really interesting point. Now, you know, a lot of people, when they get on this subject of doing more with less, and especially this issue of how can we have larger class sizes and still teach effectively, they jump right to technology. Online learning, digital learning, blended models, the Khan Academy, flipped classrooms, all of this. I detected some skepticism from you, but what's your take on technology as a piece of this?
Well, this one puts me in a tough position. In my private sector life, I did a lot of computer programming myself. We purchased a lot of technology, and technology was an important way of, in my private sector life, of substantially reducing costs and raising quality. So I get it. My public sector education experience has looked like this. We wanted to bring in Rosetta Stone to teach foreign language. This is an online or on-disk, self-directed, should be really, really cost-effective. So how did we approach it? Step one, build the Rosetta Stone classroom. Step two, go and buy 20 computers. Step three, schedule it during period one. Step four, bring in a certified language teacher to supervise it. So at the end of the day, using Rosetta Stone became the single most expensive way of teaching a foreign language. I paid for a teacher plus technology, and then the technology sat unused 6 out of 7 periods a day. Now, the hope and the promise would have been, hey, Rosetta Stone could be effective. All of our kids have computers. Almost all of them have access to the internet. Let them take the course at home. Let us test for mastery. And if they learn the language, let's give them credit. That could have been the most cost-effective solution. And maybe there's some blended mix of partially online and partially classroom. So in the book, I have a healthy skepticism. I believe that technology should lower costs and raise achievement in public schools, because that has happened in every other aspect of our lives. But I will say that the vast majority of experiences I've had and seen is that it has not done that yet. Then the last technology point is Bill Gates, I believe in the early 90s, and he knows a little bit about technology and a little bit about education, a lot more than me, talked about technology as the backbone, back office, the infrastructure of managing a school district, the data systems, and the way you process HR. And I think school systems have been really slow to embrace back office technology, things that corporate America did in the 70s. And that's a place where I think there is certainly an immediate benefit, and we're still probably going to have to think through how we use it for teaching and learning, although I suspect eventually it will be an important part of doing more with less.
And with your Rosetta Stone example, why didn't you do it in the online way, or seven periods a day, or with a paraprofessional instead of a licensed teacher? What happened?
This is the idea of, we keep trying to take new methods and force them into our old mold. The department head of foreign language essentially announced that I will not give credit for a course that doesn't have a teacher. The guidance office said we don't give credit for things that aren't in your schedule. The technology people said, you know, we need dedicated equipment because it's got to be a little bit different from the computers in the library. We didn't adapt all of our systems and procedures. We bought new technology, shoved it into an old model, and it didn't become cost effective. But nothing physically would have stopped us from making it efficient and changing those things, but we didn't.
Okay. All right. Another third rail topic, perhaps the touchiest, special education. A lot of studies showing that this is an ever-growing part of the education budget, but most people consider it untouchable, thanks to federal law and the court decisions. And, you know, these kids with disabilities have a federal right to a free, appropriate public education. So how do you touch special ed?
I think we need to start with that they have a moral right, and we as educators have a moral obligation to give them a great education. And we need to be able to say publicly that we're not doing that. Kids with special needs, particularly mild to moderate special needs, do not learn at acceptably high levels. So we are spending a lot of money. We care a lot. But the results, if it was my son or daughter, are just unacceptable. And I think we need to put the focus on learning, not spending. And the good news is there are a lot of ideas, things that we did in Arlington, things that other districts are doing, that really raise achievement and lower costs in special education. We just have to be willing to tackle it. And I know it's a topic that scares a lot of people.
All right. So let's talk about the staffing models, because, again, it seems like a lot of this comes down to how you staff classrooms and how you approach kids with special needs and get them the services they need.
Sure. There has been, either consciously or unconsciously, this decision made that if we have more bodies and smaller classes, that kids with special needs will learn, even if it means that the people who are doing the teaching may not have strong content knowledge, may not be good teachers of the subject. So let me get really specific. Take a kid named Nate, and he's in middle school, and he struggles in math. The typical solution is either take five kids like Nate and put them in a classroom with a special education teacher who may not have taken a single math class since high school, and maybe not even 4 years of math in high school, a teacher who would never be hired by the math department. But five kids, one teacher, and that non-math teacher is intended to teach me math. We should not be surprised that I didn't learn a lot of math or that we spent a lot of money doing it. Maybe the alternative, very popular, is co-teaching, where that non-math teacher jumps into a classroom with a regular math teacher. And there might only be, in some districts we've seen, as few as two or three students that special education teacher is supporting. So the costs went up even further, but she's still not a math teacher. What we did in Arlington is we said, you know, if you don't know how to do math, we should put a really, really great math teacher in front of you. And we would pull 10 or 15 or 18 students, give them two periods of math, both from math teachers. You didn't need to have an IEP to get the support, so it actually made it even more cost effective. And we saw the achievement gap shrink by 65%, and the cost per student dropped dramatically.
And so what you're saying, though, is now these kids, including those with IEPs, no longer are getting a pullout program or a special aid in the classroom. They're just getting a double dose of math. Makes a ton of sense, but do parents go along with that?
You know, it all depends how it's presented. What we have found, and here at the District Management Council, where I'm a managing director, we have helped a lot of districts move in this direction. If the parents believe that they're going to get high quality teachers, you know, math teachers and English teachers who are top at their game and want to be teaching these classes, yeah, parents get it in a heartbeat. Special education teachers, that is a harder sell, and I understand that. But our experience has been that the parents readily and quickly understand that if you can't read, a reading teacher would be a great solution, and if you can't do math, a math teacher would be a great solution.
Such common sense, and yet, what's your? Do you think this is happening in many places around the country?
I mean, it is happening here and there. You know, I get emails from people who have read this and have written about this a fair amount, and they'll say, yes, this is what we've been trying to do, or yes, this is what we've been doing, but it's always with this kind of conspiratorial twist of they're not telling the special ed director, or they're not telling the superintendent. They're just doing this under the surface because they, as you said, saw it as common sense. And what we're hoping to see over the next few years, that this becomes something that the district is endorsing, that this is becoming the norm because it's the right thing for kids, and it's just a corollary that it happens to be a whole lot less expensive.
Right. And it should become standard practice. All right. Well, you end your book, and I love this, with a chapter on getting started. So you start with the end in mind here. What advice do you give superintendents who are ready to give this plan a go?
I think there are two bits of advice. The first is for them to believe in their heart and soul that managing a tight budget can and will be beneficial for students. It's just really hard to get up in the morning and get excited about just managing a budget for the sake of a balanced bottom line. But when this becomes the primary driver, the mechanism to help a lot of kids learn a whole lot more, it's actually very energizing. And then the second bit of advice is you gotta pick your battles carefully. A lesson I learned way too late in my experience. That there will be great ideas that the public or your own district's not ready for. And sometimes you gotta take a step back, share the knowledge, do that joint fact finding, and get them ready for the ideas. And then they will follow you. But as we started this conversation, tough times are here. We're gonna either manage declining budgets in a way that's very harmful to students by just cutting services and doing less with less, or we're going to use this as an opportunity to rethink how we serve kids and do it even better.
And Nate, one last question. I mean, that message that is so central to this book, do you think it's getting through to teachers, to parents? Do people think that, oh, it's just the recession, and when the unemployment comes back down, the recession's a few years behind us, we'll be able to go back to the way things were?
I think it's mixed. I certainly get lots of calls from superintendents who believe, as I do, that the world is changing, that we're looking at 10 or 15 years of reduced per pupil spending and reduced staffing levels. And they want to make the changes proactively. They believe we can do better, even though we will have less. And then I also see a lot of school boards and superintendents trying to ride out the storm. And I don't blame them. In the past, that worked. You know, a couple years, and then everything came back, and all that we lost was replaced. All the research says that's not going to happen for 10 plus years. So we should stop waiting and start doing more with less.
Okay, thanks so much. Again, this has been Nate Levinson, the author of Smarter Budgets, Smarter Schools. Nate, thanks so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.